This is Fresh Air, I'm Terry Gross. A low-budget exploitation film from 1965, starring Sal Mineo, has just been re-released and may be on the verge of achieving cult status. The film, Who Killed Teddy Bear, was described in one recent press release as a smorgasbord of Hollywood taboos. Voyeurism, pornography, masturbation, incest, child abuse, transvestism, lesbianism, and the most explicit rape sequence yet filmed. So it's quite surprising to learn that the director, Joseph Cates, is well known in the TV industry for producing family fare, including hundreds of circus programs, the Emmy Awards, the Tony Awards, and the Magic of David Copperfield specials, and he produced the annual Command Performance Salute to the President. Early in his career, Cates directed The $64,000 Question. Even though his work predated the quiz show scandal by several years, when the scandal broke, he couldn't get work in TV. So Cates took a brief sidetrack into making cheap, quickie films. Who Killed Teddy Bear stars Juliet Prowse as a DJ in a discotheque who gets anonymous sexual phone calls by a man whose fantasy life is built around her. The caller is played by Sal Mineo.
Hello. Look, I know there's someone there, and it's 6 o'clock in the morning.
I know you don't know me, but I know you very well.
Who is this?
I know what you look like right now. I can see your skin. You have the most beautiful, smooth, hard skin.
Look, is this your idea of a joke?
I'm very warm. I could feel your hands touching me all over.
I don't have to listen to that. Go sober up.
Juliet Prowse is alone and afraid. Soon a cop is on the case, but this cop makes Prowse uneasy because he's so obviously obsessed with investigating sex crimes. The cop is played by Jan Murray, who you may remember as a comic and game show host.
Well, we were discussing the telephone psychotic, which is generic, like saying animal. It's a beginning, period. And you start to break it down. Lion, giraffe, mouse.
That was no mouse that called me.
Some are fetishists, some are sadists, some are masochists. Then there are the simple voyeurs, the paedophiliacs. But even that's too neat, too much like rules. So we have the combinations. And I'm not talking about your Uncle Charlie who buys pinup calendars. I mean the complicated pairings. The sadomasochists, the voyeur masochists, the exhibitionists, the necrophiliacs.
You seem to know a lot about these things.
Someone should.
There was no Hollywood code anymore when you made your movie, but there are still things that one didn't show on screen. And you violated what were still then some taboo things in Hollywood. For example, we see what we clearly understand to be Sal Mineo masturbating. We don't actually see him touching his private parts, but we see him in jockey shorts, you know, in briefs, just kind of touching his thigh in a very suggestive way. Tell me how you decided to handle that.
Well, you know, it's more as a craftsman. We didn't set about and say to ourselves, gee, let's connive to do these things that are tasteless in the movie. There was a story, and we had to figure out a way to do it. And I had a very artistic director of photography, a man named Joe Brunn, who was also a painter. And I would discuss these matters with him, and how to communicate. Well, it was very obvious. It was perfectly legal, if you will, to put the actor in tights. He had a splendid physique. And if he wanted to stroke his arm or stroke his stomach or stroke his thigh, and we shot it in a manner that would communicate the idea that he was a pervert. Well, what was wrong with that? It was a craftsman's decision, is what I mean to say.
You said he was wearing tights. Did you mean briefs?
I mean shorts.
Shorts.
Yes.
Now, was this among the first times that we see a male lead in a movie wearing briefs instead of boxer shorts?
That I can't answer. You'd have to ask a film historian. Incidentally, He wore those briefs because that's what Sal Mineo wore normally.
Another taboo I have to ask you about. There's a rape scene in the movie, and you don't see anybody naked in it. You know, you don't see anything explicit. But I think in terms of the reactions on Juliet Prowse's face, it's actually very explicit for its time. And
well, you know, you're quite right. You don't see anyone opening the pants.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see the skirt going up. As a matter of fact, it's a rather awkward moment when it's ended, when everyone stands up and, you know, they look fully dressed. So it was designed to play it off of the face. I mean, it was directed that way so that you would understand clearly what was taking place. And yet, if you read it in the script, is it censorable? I don't think so.
Now, I'm interested in your casting of Sal Mineo. I think he had a hard time in his career getting roles as an adult after his successes in Rebel Without a Cause and in Exodus, in which he was still playing teenagers. Was it hard to get him? Was he interested in doing a film that cast him as a sexual pervert?
Sal Mineo was an actor, and he thought it would be a very good role. And you're quite right. He had difficulty getting roles. He certainly had difficulty getting roles.
May we say
adult.
Here that I think part of the difficulty was that he was rumored to be gay, and I think that hurt his career, too.
Well, probably that's so. I don't think it hurt his career because there were others who were rumored to be gay. I just think he was difficult to cast as an adult. He probably would have made a better villain than a leading man or a hero.
What was difficult about him?
Just his appearance, his voice, his sense. There is a... I mean, he can be an engaging young man. You see that in one or two places in the film. But he's not a classic leading man. So what do you cast him as when he's an adult?
Mm-hmm. So how did he feel about the role?
He was a professional.
Uh-huh.
He was getting paid for it. So he's very much interested in how to do it properly. And he contributed very much in many different ways. Those were natural gestures of his that you referred to. He wasn't directed to stroke himself. When he went into rehearsal, he fell into that natural gesture. We just placed the camera to record it.
Mm-hmm. Now, he makes some obscene phone calls to the Juliet Prowse character because he's just absolutely obsessed with her sexually. What were your language constraints?
Well, remember, you really didn't hear very much of what he said.
Right.
The little that you did hear was just that he thought about her a lot and he had her in his mind and he wanted to be with her and that kind of, you know, bland, suggestive language, if you will.
No, the Sal Mineo character reads a lot of pornography, and there are shots in Who Killed Teddy Bear of magazines, and we see magazine covers with pictures of women with bare breasts. Now, I think you couldn't have actually shown bare-breasted women in a movie, but I guess you could show the picture of it.
Well, first of all,
yeah,
those are exterior scenes in New York. They were all stolen. There were no permits or anything set up. There were no 15 trucks parked on a street. We went out in a car. The car had a driver and had the director of photography in his camera. It had Sal Mineo in the back seat, a makeup person, and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I just walked into that magazine store, gave the guy 10 or 20 bucks, and said, we want to shoot here. It'll take 10 minutes. And so everything you see is real. We didn't place it. We didn't position it. You know, for emphasis,
mm-hmm.
It's real. And part of it was maybe to suggest in the movie what fed this suggestible psychotic. And what fed him, maybe I was trying to be moral at that point, because I'm really against that kind of open exhibition of magazines. You saw real window displays. You know, you saw real motion picture marquees and you saw real magazines, all readily available, all in the window, all open to whomever passes by.
Well, what were the film standards at the time in terms of showing magazines with naked women on the cover?
I think, ours was a slightly sleazy film.
I like the way you put that.
I enjoyed the Village Voice review, which started out, "It's crummy." First two words, "It's crummy, but strange, but very stylish, and strangely enough, eminently watchable." I appreciated that. All true.
My guest is Joseph Cates. He directed the 1965 film Who Killed Teddy Bear, starring Sal Mineo. It's just been re-released. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Joseph Cates, he directed the 1965 film Who Killed Teddy Bear, which has just been re-released. Now, I want to get back to the casting. You cast Elaine Stritch in the role of the discotheque owner. And so Elaine Stritch is the character who... She plays the character who employs Juliet Prowse, the object of the Sal Mineo character's sexual fantasies, and he plays a busboy at the club. Now, Elaine Stritch, I'd say, is most famous for her roles in Noel Coward musicals and her subsequent roles after your film in Stephen Sondheim's Company and in, the revival of Showboat that's on Broadway.
Yeah, she's a musical artist.
Yeah, and quite wonderful. I think she's wonderful in your film. Now, she plays a very tough lady, and the implication is that she's probably a lesbian. We don't know for certain, but there's a scene where she seems to be coming on to Juliet Prowse. It's kind of chilly in the house, and she puts on a fur coat and says to Juliet Prowse, "I love soft things. Do you love soft things?" Now, again, the code, which was already gone, had kind of outlawed the depiction of gay and lesbian characters. Had there been many gay or lesbian scenes up to that point?
I suppose that any gay or lesbian theme was kind of buried. It could be suggested in ways, there could be clues in the scene, but it was never overt. And so it is in Who Killed Teddy Bear. It is overt. Juliet Prowse says to her, "Look, if I'm mistaken, I'll apologize later, but please leave." We make very clear, we try to make clear, and how do you do that without being offensive, that she is a lesbian. But it's still unclear enough for Juliet to say, you know, if I'm wrong, leave. The putting on of the coat was simply a plot device so that when she left wearing the coat, Sal Mineo would think that that was Juliet Prowse and
because it's
her.
Juliet Prowse's coat, so it's one of these mistaken identity things.
Yes, very, very weak, very implausible.
You cast Jan Murray as a cop who's obsessed with solving sex crimes. Now, Jan Murray was a Borscht Belt comic, a game show host. He hosted, like, all the game shows. What made you think of him as this kind of hard-boiled cop? It's such he's actually quite good in the role. I've never seen him in anything like that.
I do good casting. Interesting casting. Well, you know, first of all, I was very friendly with Jan Murray. And Jan Murray, who was then, yes, doing the quiz show and very successful at it, was studying acting with Wynn Handman. He was studying dramatic acting. We would have dinner and he would tell me about it. Now, when I cast Mineo and Prowse first and then I got Lane Stritch, I had absolutely no money after Mineo and Strauss to spend for casting, and I needed a leading man to play a detective in New York, right? An ethnic detective is interesting, and I always saw in Jan a kind of a rugged look. He's believable as a cop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's got a voice, and he, you know, and he's got a rugged physique, and he was willing to work for scale.
Importantly, right?
For 4 weeks, and he was rather, and also he was kind of a name. He added, you know, a little substance to it.
Yeah, whoever expected Jan Murray and Sal Mineo to be in the same movie?
Well, you know, it's a question of opportunity. Jan Murray, given the opportunity and the parts to grow, would have been a very effective actor, very successful actor.
Now, Dan Travanti, formerly of Hill Street Blues, has a small part as a deaf bouncer.
We made him deaf because we couldn't afford in the budget to have him speak.
Why not?
Because I'd run out of money. You know, you have to understand something. I wasn't just the director. I was the producer, and I had guaranteed the budget. And I didn't buy completion insurance or anything of that sort. And I wasn't out to lose whatever money I had. So the budget was very strict. And when it came to casting the part, we just figured, make him a deaf mute. It's not only interesting, but it limits the amount of money we have to pay him. It was his first role.
Oh, you mean because you paid him less because he didn't have speaking lines?
Correct.
Oh, I thought you were saving money on the microphone. I see.
No. Also, he was just out of school, and he was very happy to get his first job.
Right, he even spelled his name differently back in 1965.
Oh, did he? I didn't notice that.
Yeah, I think it had a Y at the end instead of an I.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Well, that was the magic change for him, wasn't it? A Y to an I, and lo and behold, a television star.
So, how did Who Killed Teddy Bear get re-released?
You know, I know backwards. My son lives in California. And one day he called me up. He said, Dad, you're not going to believe this. I found a flyer which says that there's the midnight screening of a cult movie. And it's Who Killed Teddy Bear. So I said, well, why don't you go and see? So he went to see it, and he met the man from Strand Releasing, who said, you know, I found a print of this film. We don't know who owns it. So my son called me, and I told him who to call. It's now owned by Todd A.O., and which is run by a man named Salah Hasnain, who was involved originally at the UA Theater Circuit. And I said, see if he can, you know, make an arrangement with him. See, because they weren't charging for these midnight screenings. They didn't have the rights to it. Strand did indeed make the arrangement, and they're putting it out. And Strand, as I understand, and I'm certainly not being critical, Strand does tend to release films of special appeal to the gay audience. And I hope indeed that they come and see it.
Now, do you think the film is being received differently now than it was in its time?
Yes, I do.
What's the difference?
I think the difference is, I don't know the word for it, but I think the film gives you a window on 1965.
Yes, right. Not only on how the streets of New York looked and what people were wearing, what the music was, but also what the kind of standards of morality was in movies. What was really seen as going too far?
Well, partially that, but I think very much so. The music, the dances, the mm-hmm. way people dressed, the way they looked.
Oh, there's a great scene of a couple frugging.
Yes, and it's real. Those were not dancers.
No, you could tell. Yeah.
So, I think that that's kind of a window on that world, the street scenes in particular. I think there's a great... Sal Mineo became kind of a cult figure through the years.
Yes.
So I think that that's of particularly strong appeal. I think his sexual ambiguity, you know, at the time, is now... It's interesting to view years later in performance. So I think there are other things working. Now, listen, the picture is not a smash hit. I understand it did fair business. It deserves to do a lot more.
You have, four children?
Yes.
And now they're getting to see the film for the first time. Did they know about it beforehand? Had they seen it before? What's the reaction?
No, of course not, because two of them were 2 years old and 3 years old at the time. My son had seen it in California. So I went with my two older daughters to the opening night screening and with my two son-in-laws. And, of course, they had no idea that I had ever been a film director. I mean, vaguely, Daddy, once, you know, in the middle, they think of me as a television producer. So to actually walk in and see on a big screen a film, and particularly a film in this subject matter, was a little startling to them. You got to remember, my reputation was for family entertainment. Eye shows and magic shows and circuses and musical programs and, you know, and pageants. And it was really family entertainment. And then they come in and they see this, you know, it reminded me, I had a brother-in-law. I have a brother-in-law who was once an attorney for Penthouse, and then he became an attorney for Playboy, and his children used to call him Porno Papa. I think my children were impressed. I have one daughter who's an actress, you know, Phoebe. And my son-in-law...
Oh, your daughter is Phoebe Cates.
Yes.
Oh.
And my son-in-law is Kevin Kline. And I think it was wonderful for them because they never think in terms of me as having any knowledge or experience with film. And I think they were very interested in seeing it. And then my other daughter, Valerie, is a writer, and my other son-in-law is an artist. And they were particularly impressed. I mean, they really found, you know, a surprising merit in it for its time.
For its time.
But
he
you
said.
Know, it's great. It's great to amaze your children many years later.
So is the movie going to come out on video?
Yes. Oh, I look forward to that.
Do you know when?
No, I have no idea.
Okay.
I think they'll start shopping it pretty soon. They'll take the New York reviews, and once they've got it booked around, that'll create some interest in it. It'll just be great for me to send out as a Christmas gift, you know, to a lot of dignified people and say, see, I was a roisterer in my youth.
Well, Joseph Cates, thanks so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Joseph Cates directed the 1965 film Who Killed Teddy Bear. It's just been re-released. It's already played in New York and will open in more cities in June. This is Fresh Air.